You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be as the cameras start going off in the background.
We do our best. My guests Gaia Lutz, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rhys Sheridan will be discussing Donald Trump's Davos speech and the day's other top stories, including the Guggenheim Museum's counter-offer to Trump's request to borrow a Van Gogh, Australia Day and the attendant row thereabout, and we welcome a new citizen to the United Kingdom. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Gaia Lutz, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Welcome all. And we will start tonight with the plutocrat Woodstock that is the annual World Economic Forum in Davos. Today's headliner was US President Donald Trump, who read out what was, by his own unexacting standards, a relatively sane and orthodox speech, though he did take a self-pitying swipe at the news media, which, despite his previous complaints and threats, continues to report things he does and says. But with all due recognition that we may be undermining our own skepticism by leading the show with this question, is Davos really this big a deal? Tom Edwards, is it?
Listen, I'm kind of conflicted about this, which our listeners will no doubt be delighted to hear. We'd keep talking frequently. You've cited Trump, obviously, at the top, and he's the headline story today, about polarization in politics, and wherever we look, this seems to be the story. The extremes are the people who are shouting loudest. Now, for that reason, if there is a forum, however rarefied, literally and metaphorically it may be, where global leadership, to use a slightly, you know, clunky umbrella term, get together to talk about addressing the challenge of polarized politics or fragmented society, then I think broadly that's a good idea. The sort of caveat to that is that where Davos, where the World Economic Forum suffers, is it gives an impression of being an echo chamber. It sounds like empty rhetoric. And I think that's mainly because they haven't refined how the very sensible and often very pragmatic messages that they broadcast during the days that it's on are actually then enacted in a meaningful way. The World Economic Forum, Davos, as a location, it lacks delivery. Now, that's partly because the mechanisms maybe aren't there for these sorts of supranational things. But I think that the leadership, whether of Davos or the global leaders who are there, need to put as much effort into flying in by helicopter and sort of producing the right sound bites. They need to marry that up with actually some meaningful action. Now, it could just be that the problems are too profound for them to do that, but I think they need to try harder.
Gaia, to pursue that thought a little further, even if, as Tom suggests, this might actually be a useful and productive gathering, are the optics of it a bit tricky? In this day and age when there is increasing concern, whether it's justified or not, about the world being run by unaccountable elites, this is a bunch of rich people flying private jets to a mountain in Switzerland.
Yes, I think I'd agree with Tom a little bit that, you know, wherever there is dialogue, there is, you know, hope for a change. But I do think Davos has become a sort of exaggeration, let's say, of almost a caricature of exactly what we don't need, which is more of this, you know, the rich meeting to, I mean, in essence, it is the rich meeting and discussing how to make more money. I know that's not what it's supposed to be. It's how to heal a fractured world.
It's not what they put on the poster.
It's not what they put in the poster, but it is through capitalism. And capitalism has been proven again and again to make the rich richer, the poor poorer. And these questions are not being addressed. I think they try to address that with a very vague statement, how to create a shared future in a fractured world. But I just don't think there's enough answers to that. I mean, they've been talking about this every year at Davos, and I don't think a lot of useful measures come out of it. That's not to say that we shouldn't be encouraging dialogue and people shouldn't be meeting. You know, there are plenty of organizations that encourage this kind of thing that I agree with. But I just think Davos has become a bit of a celebrity, glitzy, elitist gathering.
I think it's instructive to look back to the beginning of Davos, because when it begun in 1971, it was given the riveting title of the European Management Symposium. And it was started...
Are you saying you preferred it when it was on Sub Pop?
It was. This is what I'm saying. They sold out, man. No. So it was started by this business professor from the University of Geneva. And it was actually only in the late 80s that it kind of got sexy and rebranded as Davos. And then the next year, in 88, the Davos Declaration was signed between Greece and Turkey, which like stopped a major conflict. F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela met there in 1992. And it kind of only, not relatively recently, but only in midlife did it assume the kind of mantle that it's placed on today. Now, I think when you consider that it was begun as a kind of management symposium, it perhaps becomes less surprising that its focus is so technocratic. And maybe we're just expecting too much from it.
Tom, we should address Donald Trump's speech. Did he say anything that struck you as especially interesting? I mean, he was rude about, you know, our profession and our colleagues, but then he always is. And frankly, I think you've got to kind of take that as a compliment. But that aside...
Not really. I mean, I think it's instructive that Donald Trump went to Davos at all. If you consider that the last US president to go to the World Economic Forum was Bill Clinton, I think I'm right in saying, which may surprise some, particularly if you look at the fact that Trump has, and he was quite clear about it today, he's used it as a platform to espouse his America First agenda, which rings rather hollow when you're talking about combined global efforts to meet some of the great challenges that we all face as a collective. One of the reasons I think that Trump actually went, certainly one of the reasons why Narendra Modi went and spoke quite impactfully on the first day, was because they were both wary of the coverage that President Xi got last year. And I think this is one of the problems. Nation states understandably do what is politically expedient, and their leadership follows the same line. Trump went there because it is what wins the day in headlines for Trump today. Yeah, to go back to what Guy was saying about lacking substance, I mean, you kind of guaranteed that with Trump even before he arrived.
Well, let's move along slightly, because one of the perks of being President of the United States is the license within reason to redecorate the White House with your choice of artifacts from the United States' richly stocked museums. According to reports in American media, just such a request was made to New York's Guggenheim by Donald Trump. Or perhaps, given that the work solicited was Van Gogh's landscape with snow and not a picture of dogs playing poker, someone acting on his behalf. The Guggenheim said that the Van Gogh was unavailable, but offered in its stead Maurizio Cattelan's America, which is an installation comprising a fully functioning solid gold toilet. Gaia, is this a bit, I mean, okay, all jokes aside, is this a bit ill-mannered of the Guggenheim? I mean, they've had a request from the White House, and this is their response.
You could say so, but actually, as a matter of fact, I think it is quite in taste with Trump's aesthetics. But honestly, I think...
He's probably... His response to being offered a solid gold toilet is quite likely to be, I've got one.
Exactly. And we might laugh about it and see this as a sort of a satire to, you know, whatever it is that Trump is, Trump's America or whatever. But I mean, I think he might just well see it as a valuable toilet.
You think
toilet.
It's thoughtful?
I think he might just think it's a thoughtful... I mean, not when he reads all the press coverage it's been getting, but I think if he got that from any other colleague, he might say thank you very much and install it.
He might just think, cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I have myself in my time set foot in a tyrant's bathroom. I visited the former Basra Palace of Saddam Hussein, the bathroom of which was not solid gold, and it wasn't even gold-plated. It was kind of just tacky, faux-painted gold. As one of the Welsh guardsmen who showed me round said, it looked rather like someone in Merthyr Tydfil had won the lottery. but is it... I mean, we'll talk a bit more about the gesture shortly, but... Henry, I want to put to you the fact that the art in itself, this installation by Maurizio Cattelan, is just terrible, terrible crass adolescent sub Banksy drivel. I mean, this really should have a caption next to it saying, think about it, right, kids?
I don't fully understand. Sorry, let me rephrase that. I don't understand, full stop, most contemporary art, and I would be loath to.
I don't think the text of this one is that deeply buried. He's made a solid gold toilet and called it America.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you that it seems to be a fairly cack-handed gesture in the kind of mode of Banksy or some Damien Hirsts. Does the fact that it's bad art change this gesture for you? Is that... Oh, sorry, Tom.
Can I jump in? I mean, everyone's had their pop on Maurizio Cattelan. I love Maurizio Cattelan. I think he's wickedly funny, super clever. Granted, you can take any one piece out of context and it seems slightly ridiculous. Contemporary art, in a sense, began with someone having fun with a piece of toilet-based furniture.
This is Marcel Duchamp,
way back in the start of the 20th century. Cattelan's really funny, and there is a sort of mordant wit to it. I think you, like all these things, the meaning is in the eye of the beholder. I was listening to Bridget Riley talking last week at her new show in London, and she said, I don't want to get all sort of artsy here.
No, please do.
But she was talking about the fact that the work is defined by the viewer's participation. Now, with the solid gold toilet, you don't want to participate too immediately, Andrew, but its meaning is as heavy with symbolism or not as you choose to make. Just speaking to the man's defence there.
Making the case that the Guggenheim's gesture is in itself an act of Dadaist satire?
Well, a little bit. I think it's witty. I think it's funny. Trump supporters might say it's a low blow, and I'm sure actually a lot of his base, who probably agree with Henry in terms of the role that modern art should be playing in society.
What, this is firewood?
No, but they might be saying, look, you know, this is classic. This is the president, our guy, and here's the sort of metropolitan elite throwing two fingers at him because they don't respect the democratic process. But I think this is actually something which we should commend. If you have somebody like Trump, why not try a bit of wit? I like the idea of getting an aesthetic provocateur, even sort of secondhand in this case, Maurizio Cattelan, involved in sticking it to the man.
I have to agree with Tom. You know, we did a big interview with Glenn Lowry recently, and he said, you know, when Trump was elected, and he's the director of the MoMA in New York, they had trouble in thinking what kind of exhibition they could do that wouldn't, you know, reinforce that they're just this liberal metropolitan elite museum. But they thought of a smart and, I think, witty way of, you know, they just chose to portray paintings by artists who would be affected by Trump's travel ban. And they didn't say anything else. They just chose to do that. And I think, you know, he had a very interesting line in that interview where he said, look, I am happy to debate and to have a dialogue about if this was the right move for us, if this wasn't. But the important thing is that we are having this conversation. And yes, it is a bit witty and it is maybe a bit ill-mannered, but I think it's solely in the museum's right to do something like that. Plus, it is a valuable piece of art. They are offering Trump a valuable piece of art to his home.
But Henry, could Trump not merely return the serve and claim to have hit a winner if his response was, cool, bring it round, wire it up, plug it in?
Yes, I think that would subvert the subversion. Again, I would encourage him to do so. While you two were speaking, actually, I got to thinking that I wonder if it is easier to conflate this attack on Trump by a major, New York museum, well, a major world international museum, as an attack on his base, because it is coming from the kind of institution that, you know, we would consider to be, well, you know, we might think they wouldn't be interested in, or we might think would be occupied by kind of liberals in their ivory tower, however you want to put it. Is it easier to conflate it when it's a gesture from an institution like that than when it's just, for example, a politician or a celebrity taking a personal pop at Trump? Like, what does that say about the way in which we group together, you know, different kind of...
Well, the Fox News segment about the snotty, latte-slurping metropolitan elites mocking the people's champion does write itself, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. But why is it... the why is it so easy to do with this particular gesture rather than any other specific criticism of Trump?
I think Trump's in a slightly sort of strange, for him, kind of invidious position, because if he turns around and says, like, it was interesting, you said this attack, Henry. I mean, hardly. It's a Maurizio Catalan. He's one of the preeminent contemporary artists. Now, if Trump merely dismisses this, you know, he would presumably be wary about presenting himself as a sort of Neanderthal or as a vulgarian, or
hasn't,
someone who
hasn't worried him so far,
who doesn't understand the contemporary art scene. And, you know, in a sense, okay, it's clearly a satirical piece. It's a toilet that's gold. It's called America. It's a commentary on excessive wealth. But, you know, I think he needs to sort of roll with the punches somewhat. So I don't know. I think it will be interesting to see what his response is. I agree. I think the counterintuitive and actually quite clever thing to do would be to say, oh, it's terrific, Catalan's one of my favourites, and that would wrong for everyone. But again, does Trump have the wit for that? Possibly not.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Gaia Lutz, Tom Edwards and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, it's January 26th. It's Australia Day, but should it be?
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Gaia Lutz and Henry Rhys Sheridan. It is 230 years today since two Royal Navy escorts, three supply ships and several boatloads of seasick shoplifters sailed into what we now know as Sydney Harbour, ran up the flag of the United Kingdom and commenced the work of building the country which grew from these unpromising beginnings into Australia. The date of January 26th is now celebrated as Australia's National Day, but there is increasing argument over whether it should be. There were, of course, people who saw the first fleet arrive, and the subsequent two centuries and change have not been easy on their descendants. Gaia, as a Brazilian, you also, like me, come from a country which was built on land which was taken from somebody else. Is it gauche to celebrate that day? Because Brazil's national day is, of course, independence from Portugal, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it a bit tacky to celebrate this as the national day?
I find it a bit weird, to be honest, that we go down and celebrate the day where the Portuguese arrived. I mean, it is marked. We know that day. It's an important day in our, you know, in history books. Everyone knows it's the 22nd of April. But I think it's weird to celebrate it by having a barbecue. Not because it's perhaps not because I'm very offensive, but why not pick any other day? I just find it, sorry, Andrew, this question is to you, but I find it, are Australians that nationalist that it would hurt a lot to change the day?
Some are. I mean, there is a row over it every year, and it gets, and because it's become a, you know, a front in the culture war, the row becomes more and more rancorous. I'm actually not sure what I think. My worry is that if, and it's a genuine concern, I absolutely understand that Aboriginal Australians and descendants of Aboriginal Australians, and indeed any Australian who's ever opened a history book, does realise that there is an ambiguous aura to January 26th. My concern is that if the National Day was moved to another day, and January 26th only remains significant as the date of invasion and the beginning of the dispossession of the Indigenous peoples, then it would be forgotten. Whereas if January 26th stays Australia Day, it means every year we are actually having a row about it and we are actually having a discussion of it, and that means we are being forced to at least discuss the fact that the country, or that the territory on which the country was built, did once belong to somebody else.
Andrew, there's a statistic from the BBC that I came across while I was researching
I've seen
this,
the same survey, it's excellent.
Nearly half, 49% of Australians polled, believed Australia Day should not be on a day that is offensive to Indigenous people. That suggests that 51% of Australians think it should be on a day.
The same poll, I think I'm right in saying, done by the Australia Institute, found that the percentage of Australians who actually knew why January 26th was Australia Day was 38%.
That's correct.
So you have this lovely image of a huge row occurring over things that people having the row don't don't actually know anything about.
Imagine that.
Yeah, I know. Such is the modern age.
But do you do anything actually nationalistic on that day, or is it just a holiday? Because what I find weird is why, if it's going to become a holiday any other day, I think people are happy to have a holiday. I mean, at least when I have public holidays, I don't think about the significance.
Everyone thinks there should be a national day. I don't think anyone's saying there shouldn't be a national day.
But is it a day of reflection?
It's usually January, so it's hot, so people have a barbecue and go to the beach.
Britain's got an interesting relationship, I think, to kind of public holidays, because I think in comparison to other European countries, certainly we do not have very many holidays that are rooted in either national celebrations per se or religious celebrations.
That's because the English hate themselves.
True. We also religiously observe bank holidays. And I think that that's a peculiarity of the country that I rather like. I'm not sure what Tom thinks about it.
Well, I think what's interesting is that generally Brits aren't very good. Now, of course, we're involved in a lot of these colonial sort of discussions, the colonial legacy, of course, given that many, probably most, globally, of the misdeeds were done in the name of the motherland. So we've always been rather uncomfortable about celebrating Britishness for precisely that reason. I think it's interesting, Andrew, actually, what you said about an opportunity to reflect that may be lost if you move the day from there.
I think it would be.
And to go right back to what we said about the importance of dialogue at the beginning, viz. Davos, I actually think it's important here. My sort of inclination would be to keep it on that day for precisely the reason that you suggested, is that it prompts dialogue and it addresses that 38% that you also mentioned rather head on and says, well, look, do you understand the meaning of this? I think it's incredibly important that you don't allow detail around dates or observations. We see this wherever we go in the world to fudge the bigger issue. There are profound problems with inequality. The system remains stacked in so many ways against the indigenous people in Australia. This is sort of a storm in a teacup. And whatever the day that the national day is on won't address some of those fundamental disadvantages, inequalities, historically rooted unfairnesses. And if people got less exercised about this and put all that effort into trying to deliver some more sustainable, equalising solutions for society. And I don't mean it's only Australia. I mean, as I said, Britain is behind most of these misdeeds. Everyone would probably be better off.
Is there in fact, because I know there's St George's Day and so forth. Is there actually a British national day? There isn't, is there?
Well, no.
Queen's birthday?
I reckon half the people in the street wouldn't be able to tell you when that was.
I've got no idea.
I think it's the same. It's St George's Day. Look at the national flag, the St George Cross of England specifically. There was always a concern about displaying it because it had been appropriated by nationalist elements. That's one of the other things to reflect upon, of course, which is that the more fuel you pour onto the row about specific details, this date or the other, does that provide a platform for, you know, not well-meaning, actually the opposite, malevolent forces, particularly nationalists, who are going to use this sort of discussion to push a, frankly, rather unpleasant agenda.
The discussion of Australia Day back in the old country, as I'm sure you'll all have no trouble imagining, is not necessarily characterised by its grasp of nuance or expansiveness of spirit.
Who's shouting the loudest?
Not even extreme right. It's just your kind of paranoid, belligerent patriot types who think that if you don't celebrate Australia Day by painting the flag on your face, you're basically a communist.
Andrew, I understand the reasoning behind, you know, wanting to maintain the date for the sake of reflection, but from a practical perspective, can you ever imagine that being a platform or springboard for sensible, constructive debate?
It has been more so in the last few years. I mean, the fringes, the debate gets drowned out, as debates now always do, by, you know, angry people shouting nonsense. But I do remember the bicentennial Australia Day in 1988, because I am that old, and I think people were braced for a sort of orgy of jingo, but it didn't quite happen because Aboriginal activists, Aboriginal groups knew that date was coming and quite, you know, went about making their case very patiently and very eloquently, none more so than the veteran Aboriginal activist Burnham Burnham, who planted the Aboriginal flag on the sands of Dover on January 26th, 1988, and claimed Great Britain for the Aboriginal people of Australia. Fair point, well made, I thought.
Well, to that point, would that be the perfect day then for the revised Australia Day? What would be an apposite moment, Andrew? Anniversary of when David Boone drank all those beers on that flight?
David Boone's 52-can flight from Sydney to London, I think, is a possible
contender. It would get the popular vote.
Monocle's Ben Ryland told me there's a vote for making May 8th, so it says mate. The National Australian Day.
No, I like David Boone's half century. That's an excellent suggestion, Tom. I'm going to email it to my people.
We're
all on the same email chain. But finally tonight, as we change guests at the end of the table there, sticking with the subject of days of seismic national importance, today, January 26th, is also the day that Monocle's resident Finn, Marcus Hippie, has become another of Monocle's resident Britons. Tom Edwards, as the last actual British citizen, other than Marcus, obviously, left at this table, I think it falls upon you to formally welcome him to your country.
Marcus, I will tell a lie to all of our listeners and say it is a great pleasure to welcome you to these shores. No, in all seriousness, this is it, right?
This is such a beautiful day.
We need to rubber stamp it, but essentially, you are a citizen of these Fair
Isles.
Exactly.
So I got this letter today from...
Can I be the first to tell you, as an Australian, that your cricket teams suck?
I think I still need to learn something about those aspects of the British culture. But I have to point out that I'm not quite there yet, so I have to go to this ceremony, which I wasn't even aware of a while ago. So I thought it would be all pretty much done now once I got the approval from Home Office. But no, I need to go to my local town hall, and I have to go there and make an oath. I have to swear my loyalty to the Queen. There's a big picture of her over there. And then I don't know what happens over there.
Have they told you about the costume you have to wear?
I don't know. I know that I will have to sing God Save the Queen as well. I've been told that there was supposedly one council that would say the guests that they won't get their passports unless they can hear them sing. It sounds a bit like joining a weird religious sect, doesn't it?
Well, given that there is an established church, it literally is.
Exactly.
They haven't told you about the costume, Marcus. This is really important. Well, you know those beef-eater outfits that the guys at the Tower of London wear? It is traditional for all new citizens upon swearing allegiance to wear one.
True. The letter, though, said that cultural costumes are mostly welcome. So I've been trying to think what would be the most Finnish thing to wear. And I don't know. I think there may be a cultural conflict because in Finland, you know, we do sauna and all that, so I was thinking that, you know, if I just, you know, went naked, I don't think they would like it.
Could you dress up as a rally driver, a middle distance runner?
I could, yeah, or I could wear my skiing uniform, maybe.
Could you carry your wife?
I don't know. I think, no, I can't, because they will set a limit to the number of guests I can bring. So, no. But, yeah, it's interesting times. It's actually quite interesting psychologically as well, because when you receive that letter, all of a sudden you kind of see yourself in a different light. And I've been having moments of joy today, but also kind of moments of asking from myself why I didn't go to a country with a better weather, for example. Why didn't I not decide to relocate to Spain, for example, some time ago, or Portugal.
Marcus, you are Finnish. You don't get to go to other countries and complain about the weather. I can do that because I'm from Australia. Gaia can do that because she is from Brazil. You, however, there is nowhere that you can go and complain about the weather.
Exactly. By the way, Gaia told me that she was in Copenhagen last week and it was +4 and she went to this cafe to moan about how she's going to freeze to death over there.
I honestly felt I had frostbite in my fingers.
Anyway. You wouldn't survive in Finland.
I've been there. I lived.
Did you?
Yeah, but Marcus, do you feel noticeably British all of a sudden?
I think it's a gradual process. I've been living in this country for 6 years, and I think you gradually become more and more of a British person. So when I go to Finland nowadays, I'm actually having a weird counter-cultural shock when I go there, when I'm like, guys, why don't you speak more? What's that awkward quietness? Why do you drink so much? And why are you so weird? Strange people.
Okay, so you finally...
Anyway, Finland may just have decided to actually get rid of my Finnish citizenship.
What are you most excited about, in short, about being a Briton?
I think it's about... This is quite serious, but I think it's about feeling a fully eligible citizen over here. So to vote and kind of feel like you're in the same boat with the others. Tom Edwards, what are you mostly excited about?
What about welcoming
you in? My British citizenship.
I don't know.
Have you got any advice to Marcus about how to become British?
What are the principles of being British? The top priorities.
Be really quick because we've got about 10 seconds left.
I reckon the key thing would be you do indeed have to sing the anthem at your sort of investiture. Mm-hmm. So why not have a little practice now? The pressure's off. No one's listening to me, Dorian.
No, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to
give
you one. I'm going to give you one quick anecdote instead.
One of
the questions in my Life in the UK test was, which one is not one of the basic British principles of life? Taking care of the others and yourself, taking care of the environment, or drinking alcohol?
I think we all know the answer to that. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Tom Edwards, Guy Lutz, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Marcus Hippie, thanks for joining us. It was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by James Kitchen. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900. More music on The Atlantic Shift and more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.